This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com. Use offer code CRACKED.
Hey guys, this episode is sponsored by Cards Against Humanity, and they're sponsoring the episode, but they asked us not to read an ad because they're super cool. So, I guess, thanks, Cards Against Humanity.
Cards for Humanity.
Seriously. Enjoy the show.
This is Brother Fela Ransom Kuti. This is one time I would like to say a few things. Men are born, kings are made.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and I am joined on this intro by occasional co-host, Michael
Swaim.
And he's going to be here for the whole episode, and today we're talking about amazing, larger-than-life, super-heroic, historical, modern-day human beings who don't get their share of the fame pie.
Mm-hmm. Badasses that right. Don't get their day in the sun.
The Dos Equis Beer Company didn't need to come up with a fictional most interesting man because these people actually exist. The joke of that ad is how far-fetched all his behaviors seem in the modern world, mm-hmm. And this episode is sort of our attempt to prove that.
We've got several people on the episode today, that's their resume. That right. Whole ad campaign easily fits within their
people
resume.
People like this do exist.
Absolutely.
Soren's going to start out telling us about an explorer who is a giant and a Eskimo seductor named Peter Freuchen. Michael is going to tell us about that
billion life guy.
Yeah, the billionaire in the best sense that you can possibly be. Bill Gates looks at him jealously.
No, money's better. Yeah.
Robert Evans is going to come and tell us about a guy who invented the gun that Dirty Harry carries, who makes Dirty Harry look less like Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about one particularly badass soldier in World War II that happened to be from the wrong country to get big budget Hollywood movies made about them. We'll talk about Charlie Chaplin's Hitler fighting when Hitler fighting was not cool, man.
Yeah.
Michael, you talk about George Meyer, one of the most underrated comedic minds mm-hmm. ever.
Still working today.
I talk about Martha Gellhorn, the greatest and most badass reporter of the 20th century. We talk to Evans about two modern day Marines who just walk around Iraq and Afghanistan without body armor or guns because we wouldn't want people walking around with body armor and automatic weapons in our neighborhood. Yeah, so why should they do that? Super dangerous, but they do it because
huge body count this episode. But we start with the guy who saved a billion lives, so it's like, really, you're never gonna kill that many people in the episode.
Right.
So
we're working with house money after that
exactly.
guy. Evans talks about protesters in Kiev. Who kind of got into a fight with the leader and the military in their country, and they got shot, in fact, for protesting one of their president's decisions, and responded by building a snow fort in the middle of the city and creating a motorized cavalry out of cars and motorbikes and turning their city basically into a Mad Max movie in the snow. Michael talks about a point in human history where the species, our species, the human species, was down to 2,000 people wandering around in the desert. We were on the ropes, and just like an underdog Disney movie, we not only survived, but found a new gear of awesomeness that took us to the top of the food chain.
Now we're just too old for this shit.
Michael and I will be back to share a medley of four unknown badasses we've edited together into one badass life. And then we end things talking about a country that you associate with chocolate and army knives, and you should associate with hollowed out mountains.
And fear.
Fear. The stoic guy in the bar who can kill you with his bare hands. Mm-hmm. Like Ryan Gosling in Drive, I guess. If he was an unassuming nation that didn't wear an awesome scorpion jacket.
If he had hollow mountains full of bombs.
Exactly. Anyways, here is all of that back at the end for some footnotes.
The history of mankind is full of obvious turning points and significant events. Though tongue and tribe may differ, we are all Nigerians. We are all Africans.
We're joined currently by Soren Bowie,
number two co-host.
Yeah.
Nope.
As always.
Yep. Never. I would have introduced you as co-host if you were. So basically the way it works is that Michael and I, being co-hosts, are just going to sit back and let lesser members of the podcasting team kind of come in and present their lesser known badasses to us, and we will just sit back and judge them.
While the third co-host, Soren, I'll sit there and make a lot of good jokes and things like that.
Just saying it on the record doesn't make it true, buddy.
He'll be gone in less than 15 minutes, people.
We'll get him out of here. We got Robert Evans coming on later. It's going to be great. Just grit your teeth and bear it.
All right, well, then I'm going to get started with mine since this isn't my show, apparently. Well, I wanted to introduce everyone who doesn't already know him to Peter Fruchten, who was a Danish explorer who lived at the turn of the century.
Which?
Between the 19th and 20th century.
No, what kind of Danish are we talking? Like cheese? I'm sorry. You please go on. You're an honored guest.
He was 6'7". He started his life, he was going for a medical degree.
This isn't just a height thing, is it? You didn't just be like, I love a tall man.
That would be amazing if that was just like the tallest person Soren had ever
could easily
heard
Google.
Can you even imagine somebody who's 6'7"?
And we're talking 6'7" here.
Turn of the century.
If he had a Mini Cooper, he wouldn't even fit. He couldn't drive it. That's a waste of money right there. So this guy's 6'7". He was in medical school, dropped out to go join an expedition to Greenland. He takes a dog sled team out there and gets stuck out in the middle of Greenland and has to build a snow cave. And while he's in the snow cave, it snows in on him and he gets stuck inside the snow cave. And he has to try and dig his way out after multiple days. He's starving to death. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to claw his way out with his hands. It's not working. He had a bear skin with him and it froze. And he thought, well, I can use this frozen bear skin to scrape my way out. Didn't work. So finally, his last course of action was he shit in his own hand.
Oh, boy.
Fashioned it into a chisel.
Uh-huh.
And then chiseled his way out with his own shit. Shit saved his life.
So he's tall and frozen, he's shit in his hand.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, Soren, yeah. That's Soren's hero.
He didn't just shit that hard.
No. Yeah, no. He shits knives, Jack. That's
He ate iron pellets for days.
He shit out a chisel, basically. It was a frozen poop, and he carved it into a shiv as a prison mate might.
Yeah, so he's like a badass of resourcefulness. It's like MacGyver when you're just really balls to the wall. I don't think MacGyver would come up with that.
Yeah, I don't think MacGyver's willing to go to those lengths.
Yeah, he's like the will of MacGyver with a serious iron will.
But it gets even better, because this guy, when he carved his way out, he then had to crawl 3 miles back to his camp. And when he got there, he realized that he had frostbite up all up his leg. It started in his toes and he'd gone all the way up his leg and he had gotten gangrenous in his toe.
Mm.
And so he took shears and a hammer and he cut off his own toe with the most unuseful tools possible.
Now, how many of those tools were made from his own poop?
Just one of them. I'll make you guess which one. So he used a hammer basically to take off his own. That's like horror movie weaponry. And then after that, the frostbite was so severe on the rest of his leg that they had to cut it off and he had a peg leg. Now, if you go online at any point, you can find pictures of this guy and he looks like a mountain.
Yeah, I want to say I've been just barely paying attention to Soren, but if you Google image search, the name, this guy that I know nothing about looks really badass. Yeah, I'll give you that.
So he's got a peg leg. He's wearing a fur coat made of predators. I'm sure he slayed himself. And it has a collar that goes all the way up around his head. And he's there with one of his 3 wives. His first 2 wives were both Eskimos. They're Inuit women. And both of them died. He had to bury one of them himself because the church wouldn't let him bury her in the churchyard.
Let me just get a poop shovel out and we'll take care of it.
So he had to bury her himself. I want to just tell you a couple of things about this guy that really sell you on the mythos of who he is. Because he was such a famous explorer, different countries would have him come to their country and be like, hey, come explore our untamed wilderness, and then write about it. And it would put it on the map, basically. So Russia did that with Siberia. They asked him to come explore
Siberia. Like lobbied him to come do it.
Exactly, yeah. On his way, he was in a train that had a head-on collision with another train, which I don't even know how that happens, because you only have a rail. You have one rail.
Yeah.
Just make sure that the 2 trains aren't going the same direction on it. Had a head-on collision. All the cars were demolished, and he walked away completely unscathed. No. He is unbreakable.
It's the unbreakable movie.
And then lastly, during World War II, he was in Europe during World War II. He worked for the Danish underground. Europe was almost exclusively occupied by Nazis during World War II, and they finally caught him. Put him in prison, sentenced him to death, and he escaped, jumped over a barbed wire fence, escaped, smuggled himself to Sweden in a little fishing boat, which, I mean, that's no small jaunt. That's not a pond that he has to cross to get to Sweden. And while he's in Sweden, he decides he's going to, while he's just waiting out the war, he's going to finish out his doctorate. So he becomes an MD while he's there.
Nice.
And I'm sure learns that you're not supposed to amputate things with a hammer. I'm sure that was a big, big lesson that he learned along the way. And then he also went back to Denmark after that, got a job taking weather measurements, and went out onto an ice sheet to take these weather measurements, and got stuck in a house. While he was there, he had dogs. Wolves came and ate all of his dogs. He had to keep the door open because...
And then he had wolves. Gorillas came and ate the wolves.
You'd think if you were to meet this guy, you'd be intimidated by him. He'd be terrifying. And he'd also be kind of an arrogant asshole. So he appeared on a game show. He appeared on $64,000 Question, which was an old game show. And when you watch him on there, he's the most humble guy. He talks about whaling just briefly, and he tells these crazy Ahab-ish stories, but just glosses over them. Right. Like, everyone's, look, I'm boring you. This doesn't matter.
I've done some ice caving. I mean, you know, who hasn't dug a thing with the poop? Let's move on. Norman here was talking about his accountancy firm. That sounded very interesting.
There are things that we're not even going to talk about, which is the fact that he was a champion boxer, that he was a whaler for so long. He was a map maker. He was a meteorologist. And then when he appeared on $64,000 Question, they're asking him questions, and he's just so humble, but he knows the answer to everything. And he's got this really thick accent that I can't possibly reproduce. But he's like, oh, yeah, those are the seals of Westeros. No, really, I think I got this. Everyone should go and watch that clip of him on $64,000 Question. He wins the whole thing, by the way. Wins all $64,000. There's nothing this guy did not succeed at.
So $6,400 pyramid. It was that times version of $1 million. They were like, what? Gee whiz, mister. Off.
64 bucks and a pie? You're kidding me.
Were the questions intentionally aimed at stuff he knew?
Yes. The early on questions, they base it on stuff that you know, but they make it very, very difficult.
Now, and you've lost us. He's bullshit. Nothing he did that you described is badass now.
As you get further along in the test, they branch out the questions. That's where like the word origin thing came from. So they're trying to find your blind spots early on. Later on in the contest, there's never a point where he has to sit there
is
and think about it.
Is this the pyramid
This isn't ever,
show?
You know, it's not like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where people sit there and think about the question for a long time. You get asked the question and then they go, do you want us to repeat it? And you go, no.
You just get that faraway look in his eye where, you know, thereby hangs a tale.
And
it's torsion.
He'd shout it down from way up in the sky where he was because he was a giant. And he was always right. Never wrong. And never thought about it.
He got no wrong answers ever?
No wrong answers.
So it was just a friendly conversation or like an interview where they're like, what about this? Well, the answer, of course.
That's exactly right.
That's great. I love that.
And that's all I have to say about him.
Mm. Okay, I'll talk about someone who I think he's gotten a little more notice recently. I believe I saw either a Daily Show or a Colbert segment that referenced him at one point in the last my lifetime. But Norman Borlaug, he also won a Nobel Peace Prize, but I feel like the kids aren't out there trading Pokemon cards for Nobel laureate cards anymore. It's sad. You know, we all used to do that. Back me up. All right. So Norman Borlaug is a botanist who overcame the lodging effect by creating dwarf wheat hybrid strains.
Oh my God, I'm so bored.
Yeah, but watch me take everything and make it super punchy, unlike some non-co-hosts. By doing that, he is credited with saving roughly a billion lives. He's one of the people in the world who has compelling evidence for personally having saved ridiculous numbers of people. So he's often called the man that saved a billion lives, stuff like that. And that's because if you look at starvation projections in countries that were having a rough time, Mexico, India, and there's a third one, I don't know, Pakistan, he went over there and like made it his crusade to popularize this agriculture technique that he just knew would be helpful. And
did he invent the agricultural technique?
He did, yes. His lab pioneered the technique, and then he flew all around the world to the places where he was like, this will benefit you the most. And it turned Mexico into a net wheat exporter.
Right.
So that every kid in high school doing a report on Mexico had to change their report.
There was this trend in the 70s and early 80s, and everybody was terrified of overpopulation. That was the fear that
you'll read about. Yeah, the population explosion.
Yeah, that the population was going to explode and the earth wouldn't be producing enough food
for the number of people that lived on it. And then there would be wars for food and people would rise up and kill the rich or just starve to death in famine. And the reason that everybody was afraid of that was because that's what the projections were telling them. They were like,
right,
oh,
it
this is going to be
it was,
really bad.
We have X amount of food. Our yield increases this percentage every year. It was one of those clutch cargo moments where humanity like innovates its way out of certain destruction.
Right. And it wasn't this broad team of the world's best scientists. It was just this dude, Norman Borlaug, who was like, oh, I invented the answer. I'm going to go fly around and do this.
Yeah. And then he spent the rest of his life spreading it to other countries and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now we have more overpopulation than ever because there's too much wheat.
Way to go, Norman.
Thanks, Norman. And interesting side fact, he was 6'10". Norman Borlaug.
No,
it's not true.
Nobody's ever been taller than 6'7" in the history
exactly.
of the world.
That's why it's clearly facetious. But he did do what I consider like the EGOT of people who are too smart to care about what an EGOT is. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and the Congressional Gold Medal. That case of medals at home is just no child can live up to that.
And he won the Man Who Saved a Billion Lives Award, which he made up and gives out to anyone else who saves a billion lives, which he's the only person who's gotten
it
so far.
It's Anthony Kiedis, weirdly. Upon Norman Borlaug's death, it was just mailed to him. No one knows why.
Yeah, Under the Bridge saved me, man.
There you go.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and we will be back without Soren after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you need to create the perfect website. Recently, Squarespace took a crack at creating a tool that helps anyone design a simple logo themselves, and they're very excited to share the result with you. It's called Squarespace Logo. With the help of the Noun Project and Google Fonts, Squarespace provides over 7,000 fonts you can easily turn into a unique logo. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code CRACKED to get 10% off and to show your support for the show. Thanks, Squarespace, and you for spacing the squares. You, not Squarespace, the person who heard the ad and goes to Squarespace. Cracked is the code.
We are back. Soren is gone. He's not going to turn into a fictional character like he would on Comedy Bang Bang. Instead, he has turned into Robert Evans, who you might remember from the episode about why bad ideas stick around. He told you about why speed bumps kill a bunch of people. And now he's going to tell us about
Elmer Keith, because I don't think anyone but old men who load their own bullets for a living really know who Elmer Keith was. Now, Elmer Keith was a little kid in 1912. He was 12 years old, and he was burned by an arsonist in a horrible fire, and he lost the use of his hand. Now, at 12, he was already a champion shooter, and he decided life was not worth living if he couldn't continue to shoot guns. So he told his dad, at the age of 12, to break his hand so that they could reset the bones so that he could use it again. So he got a bottle of old granddad 110 proof whiskey, drank it down, and then his dad shattered his hand and reset it, and he went on to be one of the most famous shooters in history.
At age 12, this is correct?
Yeah, this is at age 12.
Why isn't the dad deciding
whether
or not to break his hand?
In 1912.
He was 4 years past adulthood.
Oh, I see, okay.
12
well,
years
yeah.
old, for
I mean, he was a father himself. A he had to, yeah.
granddad almost.
The other
so
dad.
Yeah, so he went on to shoot just many, many people. That's what you're, where
not
you're going
people.
With this?
The no, craziest thing about Elmer Keith, most people when they decide they want to shoot stuff at a long distance, they yeah. start training with rifles. Elmer Keith liked handguns. His most famous shot was he killed a deer at 600 yards with a snub-nosed .44. Now, for some perspective, an M16 assault rifle has an effective range of about 500 meters. An AK-47 has an effective range of about 380 meters. That's what they're accurate to.
Yeah.
He shot with a handgun a deer at 600 meters. years.
What'd he grow up to do other than shoot?
He invented the 44 Magnum cartridge, the 41 Magnum cartridge, and the 357 Magnum cartridge.
What did we have before those?
Smaller handguns that you couldn't shoot deer with at 600 yards.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So he was pissed off that handguns couldn't shoot far enough.
He was angry that handguns weren't killing enough things. And yeah. He decided to change that.
Hole is entirely too small.
He's like, the opposite of Norman Borlaug.
I can still tell that was an eagle.
The man
that
killed a billion people.
Need to invent a bigger...
And the main picture that comes up of him seems to be him with double-fisting pistols, which I enjoy, and smoking a corncob pipe at the same time.
Oh, yeah. He's got a great hat, too.
Yeah. He looks like Ranger Smith from Yogi Bear if he had just like, I fucking had it with Yogi Bear. That's it.
Getting all the picnic baskets
back. I'm going to save
back.
The fucking people in Jellystone Park are going to thank me.
So I want to dip in here while Evans gets his next one ready. Tell you a little bit about myself now.
History's greatest unknown badass.
I wanted to talk about Russia in World War II in general as being sort of an unknown badass. There's basically a law of world warring that says that whoever side Russia's on wins because they have so many people and so much land and so many resources that they're just going to keep throwing them into the meat grinder until they've worn you out. And that's basically what they did in World War II. They lost 20 times the number of soldiers as America did. They killed more German Nazi soldiers than every other country combined.
9 out of 10.
Oh, really? 9 out of 10?
Like 8 or 9 out of 10 Nazis that died in combat were killed by Russians.
So they basically won the war single-handedly and, like, don't show up in any of our movies from World War II.
GoldenEye.
Right. Was that World War II?
Yeah.
There's this one story called Pavlov's House. It's basically the Nazis had occupied an apartment in Stalingrad, an apartment building just in the city. It must have been, like, on a hill or the tallest apartment building in the city because it just had the greatest sight line for a sniper. And everybody wanted to get in. It was like a hot club. So the Nazis had taken it, and this guy, Yakov Pavlov, I'm not making that name up out of just the only two Russian first and last names I know. Yeah. His strategy for getting it back, he took 19 of his troops straight in, right where they could see him, and 15 of them were killed. And like the four that survived besides him, they got inside and he was like, all right, perfect. That was part of plan
as
A.
I planned.
Right. This is the Russian military strategy. It's like throw people through the meat grinder, a few of them make it alive, and you just have more people than anybody else. So they get in and they go room by room and basically John McClane, this Nazi occupied apartment building. But then they proceed to hold that building for days as the Nazi army, just an air force and navy, they just like sailed some ships up there just to like make sure that they had tried everything, just like bombarded it with fire bombings and blitzkrieged this one apartment building. And these four dudes held it for like a day and a half until they got back up from like 15 more soldiers. It was like nothing. The whole time there were Russian civilians, the people who lived in that apartment building were just in the basement being like, oh shit. And they survived for the whole thing. And that building still stands today.
Speaking of World War II heroes, I'm going to talk about Charlie Chaplin. He was a badass for a lot of reasons. And at the time of 1940-41, when The Great Dictator came out, he was the biggest star in the world. This was his first talkie, but talkies had come out like 12 years earlier, and Chaplin had just refused to make talkies. He'd kept making silent pictures, and they kept being the most popular things coming out in movies, even though nobody else was making silent films. In 1931, he made City Lights, which was a silent film years after they stopped being popular. Still, even though it came out during a blizzard, it broke all the attendance records because people love Chaplin so much. And another fan of Charlie Chaplin's was Adolf Hitler. Hitler loved The Tramp and all of his little bits, and Chaplin found out that Hitler was a fan. And so he spent months and months studying him and like watched how the guy gave speeches and got to the point where he could emulate him perfectly. And then he made The Great Dictator, which was not a popular move at the time. Hollywood didn't want anyone making anti-Nazi films because Germany was a huge market. This was 40, 41. This was 41 before we'd gotten into the war.
He hated Hitler before it was cool.
Right? He hated Hitler when Hitler was still kind of popular.
Was it at least partially maybe because
because Hitler is trying to steal his mustache, because we have a comedy sketch that implies that.
I think that's most of what it was.
He's like, that was my look, man. This guy's fucking coming
perfect
in.
Perfect,
like
Hitler.
It's a shame, because it was a great mustache just ruined by one asshole.
Yeah.
That's pretty stupid looking, actually.
Michael Jordan's not that bad.
So yeah, Chaplin funded this movie on his own. He knew Hollywood wasn't going to bankroll it, so he did it with his own production studio. He produced it. He paid for it out of his own pocket. And that little speech at the end that keeps circulating around the internet, yeah, when Chaplin...
That's my homepage on my internet, that speech.
Exactly. That got him subpoenaed by Congress. It violated something called the Hayes Act, which essentially stated that you weren't supposed to make propaganda against a country we weren't at war with, and we weren't at war with Germany. And,
or really do anything, like have a lady spit on the street in
have
the
a
background.
Lady spit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Hayes Commission, you can't do anything.
So there's a book from the Harvard University Press called The Collaboration, and it's about how Hollywood worked with the Nazis during the 30s and early 40s. And one thing that you'll notice, there were no films made from 32 when the Nazis came into power. There were no films made for an international audience that mentioned Jews whatsoever. There were just no mention of Jewish people in Hollywood films from that period of time. And his movie was the first one since the Nazis took power to reference that. So it got a lot of people in Hollywood angry, and it's the reason he got kicked out of the country. But he made the movie anyway.
And it referenced Hitler's anti-Semitism?
Oh, yeah. It showed
completely.
Stormtroopers shooting Jewish people on the street. No one else was even able to say, oh, I'm John and I'm a Jew.
And possibly even ballsier, in retrospect, after all was said and done. The speech, it ends with a very uplifting, one of the greatest humanitarian appeals to peace and love speeches ever, delivered by Hitler.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that background. That's crazy. You have to think that he stepped on the set today thinking, like, hopefully I can, through art, make this guy not a monster. Mm-hmm. He was trying to make a movie that would make Hitler be like, I should lighten
up. Oh, this is a bad idea. Yeah,
that's crazy.
And Hitler watched it twice. He watched a lot of movies, and there's records of what he thought about every film from like 32 to 44 or 45 that he got his hands on, except for this one. But we know he watched it twice.
Now, I'm not going to say I totally blame Chaplin, but isn't there a chance that his movie about a guy who was a big fan of him just made Hitler mad, and we have Chaplin to blame for all of World War II? Just a thought.
50-50.
Most historians can't decide. Michael, do you have any badasses that you'd like to add to the badass pile?
Always. I like to couch each of my stories with a wry observation made on the fly. It's funny how maybe we need more estrogen in the room. A lot of us have taken badass to be synonymous with, like, man, this guy shot like a lot of guys.
Or eagles.
Yeah. So my second badass is George Meyer, a comedian whose name is known to many, you know, if you're a buff or if you're a comedy fan, but I don't think to the general public at large. He is probably best known for writing a handful, like a dozen episodes of The Simpsons, and being an executive producer on The Simpsons. He co-wrote the movie and blah, blah, blah. But he did what I would call as like the Peter Freuchen equivalent, but of stuff I care about. Not care about. It's cool to marry an Inuit and poop a knife, but I knew from a young age that wasn't the path for me. So George Meyer went to Harvard, where he was the president of the Harvard Lampoon, which, if you don't know, is just a very renowned satire publication that we all very much admire. Graduated with a biochem degree, then tried to use a scientific system he invented to become a millionaire at dog racing. Lost all his money in 2 weeks, so he went to go write for the David Letterman show instead. Wrote for the Letterman show, went on Jeopardy, won a bunch of money on Jeopardy. There's a bunch of badasses who, as a side note, are
go
like,
on game shows.
I'll just win money on game shows because I need some money. Yeah. It seems like for Ubermensches, it's really easy to like get on the $6,400 question, get on Jeopardy.
They just sit at home watching their television, and everybody who comes up and has success on a game show, they're like,
why? Yeah, I can do
take that guy. That guy's ain't shit.
Yeah, so wrote for SNL, wrote for Letterman, wrote for The Simpsons, but the main thing that's so badass to me is just the variety of his experiences, and then the fact that if you look at any Simpsons writer or like dig into interviews with them, George Meyer's the name that always comes up as far as supposedly he basically ran the rewrite room. He was the one that everyone would glance to for approval when they pitched a joke. And he did rewrites on almost every episode, and the creators have said that they credit him with really shaping the flavor of the show that we call The Simpsons, which I would say in turn is now 80% of comedy. So it's just really interesting to think of how much this one guy has affected everyone's senses of humor. There's a famous quote about him, I think by John Vitti, one of the producers, who says that like the George Meyer effect would be all the writers. Their episode would premiere, and people would come back and be like, man, I loved your episode last night, and quote their two favorite lines, and they would always go, oh yeah, George added that. So yeah, he's that guy.
That's awesome, and also must be an incredible bummer for those people.
It's kind of also a bummer to be George Meyer, and he wrote so many movies and TV pilots that just fell apart. That's why I think he's good for this episode. His name never like seems to have commanded the respect, even in Hollywood, that he clearly should have.
Right, just like among comedy fans who, right, shocking as this may be to people, do not run Hollywood.
Love him or hate him or somewhere in between, Seth MacFarlane can now make movie after movie after movie, and I just feel like he kind of got glossed over in that way. He should be making whatever he wants.
I want to respond to something, Michael, you said that I thought was unfair. We're only five badasses deep, and only four of them have really been about guys who are really good at killing stuff with guns. And the very next person on my list was one Martha Gellhorn, who was basically Ernest Hemingway in every way, except she
killed stuff with knives.
Right. She was a woman at a time when like that wasn't that cool, that wasn't considered that cool, and she married Hemingway. She was his third wife, and they divorced after 4 years because he was like, stop doing what I do, you're annoying me. He got like very competitive with her. She wasn't allowed to go to World War II and report on it, so she just went undercover as a nurse to D-Day and was just like walking around in the field of battle, like on the beach reporting with,
so
like,
people
one of those
would,
ask, hats
would
with
call
the,
for a medic, and she'd be like, oh, I can't help you with that, what are you feeling though,
right? Well, no, she I'm pretty sure she put on one of those hats with the press card in it
and just walked around.
Yeah, exactly. She also had an affair while reporting World War II with a U.S. paratrooper, Major General James M. Gavin, who was the youngest commander in World War II, and that probably pissed Hemingway off too. But he like really fucked her over in a few ways, and she was a great reporter and might be the greatest embedded war journalist of the 20th century. She was like at every single major conflict, and just a total badass.
In the end, Hemingway still killed at least one more person with a gun than her, so he's a real badass.
It's a very good point, although she did kill herself after a long battle with liver. And
you know what's crazy? I thought about making that joke and then thought, don't if she killed herself. What are the odds?
And she probably didn't do it with a gun either. Yeah. But it was a good joke, Michael. A solid joke.
Yeah.
Evans, do any of your badasses qualify for
not
reasons not
lust
having to do with killing lots of people or golden eagles?
Absolutely. I've run into two people so far in all the interviews I've done for the site who both found themselves in combat zones where there were like bombs blowing up by the sides of roads and snipers shooting on like a regular basis. And both of their reactions to this, one was in Iraq and one was in Afghanistan, both guys reacted the same way, which is, I should not wear body armor or have a visible gun because then people won't be as scared of me. One of them, his name is David Kuvalon. He's a lieutenant colonel retired in the United States Marine Corps, and he was the governor of a province in Iraq after the invasion. And he refused to wear a helmet or a flak jacket or a visible gun when he was out on patrol in like Iraqi cities. And he only had two bodyguards with him most of the time. There's stories you can read of embedded journalists with him who are just terrified because they're wandering around the streets of these cities and he's not armed at all. He's got two dudes with him. And he told his soldiers, like, if you don't want to wear body armor, don't wear body armor. It's totally cool. We don't want these people to think that we're warlords. I don't want to look like Saddam walking around with a gun all the time.
If you want to wear sandals. You know, it's hot.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
And nobody died. And then this other guy was a contractor for DARPA. His two jobs were to gather intelligence, and then he used the money DARPA gave him to hook up children in Afghanistan to the internet. And he would just wander around the wilds of the Khyber Pass, which was heavily Taliban controlled without any sort of armor or weaponry or guards or anything, because he figured people would trust him more if he didn't look like a guy with a gun. And he's still alive.
It's kind of sad about passive resistance. He's an unknown badass because it all worked out and no one died, which means the story in some light is, oh, this guy walked around with no gun and nothing happened to him. But if he had died, you'd be like, everyone remembers that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is a badass and he deserves a highlight.
I was talking to a bunch of people over in Kiev in the Ukraine when they were overthrowing their whole president. And it got really ugly. There were like snipers shooting into the big protest camps and people lighting fires all over the place. And in like the thick of it, when there'd been like 30 or 40 people murdered in a 2-day spree by the government, I was talking to this one dude and he told me that his plan for that night was to brew up a big batch of chili and carry it through the streets to some people manning barricades at night because he thought they were cold and hungry.
Wow.
And I was like, are you afraid someone's going to shoot you? And he was like, yeah, that might happen, but people need chili.
Usually you set things against each other in an equation though and go... Yeah. Which is more pressing?
Not this guy.
I might get shot, but people need chili.
People need their chili.
Can you talk a little bit, because you spoke with a number of people who were over there and involved in that conflict, and we recently published an article that was sort of the result of a lot of those interviews, but I do just want to hit it on the podcast in case people missed that article, because a lot of people did. The government was getting all corrupt and shit. Their response was
the government's getting all corrupt and shit.
So basically, their president pulled out of a treaty that most of the people in the country supported. So they started protesting. It was just a bunch of college students carrying placards, which shouldn't have been any big deal, but the police beat the crap out of all of them. And so a bunch of normal people who didn't care about politics started gathering in this big city center area called the Maidan. And eventually, like, it all snowballed into them building a fortress made of ice.
Right.
To literally fight off the government.
Literally snowballed. They, like, built bricks out of snow, like the Inuit people, and created
like many
these
unknown
huge
badasses like, before them.
Right. Created these huge walls of snow and ice.
They
fortified.
Built catapults.
Yeah. They built catapults. They like started collecting spare tires from around the city, and the police were like, I don't even know why they're doing that, but I don't like it.
If I have learned anything from the podcast today, it's that I have been far too hasty to like throw out the idea of solving any life problem with, I should build an ice cave. Like a bunch of these people have responded with ice cave, and it's worked out for them really well.
It's the Swiss Army knife. Societal problems.
Last point about these guys that I just want to hit. They had a cavalry called the, what was it?
The Automaidans. The police started trying to stop people from getting supplies into this ice fortress. So a bunch of people were like, well, we'll just get in our cars and we'll make the police pull us over. Or we'll like have all of these cars driving around these police cars to stop them from pulling over the dude in the truck that we want to be able to get through. And you see all those guys on YouTube right now who hassle police when they get pulled over for as long as they can at like border checkpoints. These guys did that, but for a purpose.
Right. They were basically like the car cavalry from like a Mad Max movie.
Yeah.
They were like going around just wrecking shit up and
hunting down people. Yeah.
Yeah. Hunting down police and informants. And the article and the interviews you conducted really painted a picture of a reality that was like happening that, you know, I saw the headlines and I was like, oh, another foreign country going through revolt. But it's this crazy, dramatic action movie type reality going on.
Yeah.
That's just ordinary people doing extraordinary things for ideas that they believe in that we feel like we're just kind of too cynical sometimes or just too distracted to like really take it all in.
I kind of suspect that part of the reason that things got as crazy as they did is that everyone I talked to, these guys were all like Westerners in terms of their experience of media. They all watched the same movies I watched. They watched The Simpsons. They watch all of our, you know, the action movies we've watched. And I think it looked so much like Mad Max because everybody who was taking part in this had seen Mad Max.
Right. They're like, I bet some of those things will work.
Well, that's not a bad idea.
Boomerangs, big problem around there, I hear now. It's just metal boomerangs flying back and forth. Yeah.
I don't know if problem's the right word.
All right, those were our peaceful entries, I guess. Michael, do you have any more peaceful entries?
How do you define peaceful? Is scouring all life from the face of the earth peaceful?
I don't know, man. It was your complaint.
Yeah. Well, these people who are merely theoretical people, did not kill people with guns. I'll just say that. So I would like to talk about mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam, which is an idea of people, but they had to actually exist. If you truck with evolution and natural selection, they existed. And it's defined as mitochondrial Eve is the person on the mother's side that is the most recent ancestor that is related to everyone alive. We share our mitochondrial DNA with her on our maternal side. And then Y chromosomal Adam, same deal, on the father's side. And that can change based on boring stuff about who dies and lives. But the point is, at one point in the history of mankind's evolution, we all had the same mom and the same dad. They weren't necessarily a couple. They're different people. And those people were part of what's called a population bottleneck, which is a time period when there was a mass extinction, or for some reason, a species was like pared down and pared down and pared down and put under a bunch of pressure. And what that sort of does is forces your species to go extinct or slough off a bunch of attributes that weren't working out evolutionarily and really hone on your skills. And it'll sort of push you down the road to natural selection or becoming whatever you're kind of going to become. So I just think it's incredibly badass to know. There are a couple theories, but it's believed that there was a point in human history where there were only 10,000 humans alive on the Earth. We had a huge sprawling number of people, and then they were all killed in what was believed to be a super volcano explosion called the Toba Catastrophe that killed everyone except 10,000 people, who were like one small loose affiliation of tribes. And then they grew into everything that we are. So not only are they the first iteration of all of our survival traits that we're so proud of, but also by the definition of natural selection, they're like the hardiest. If you boil humanity and everyone dies, they're the last people left.
Right.
They must have been fucking hardcore.
I'm imagining just Jason Statham and Linda Hamilton.
Right. This was a period in time where the sky was covered in ash and no crops grew. And these are the 10,000 people that lived anyway, had children who lived, until the sky cleared and everything got better again. Post-apocalypse movies have happened in the past. And there's a competing theory that it was what's called a long bottleneck. I just looked this up today, so I could be totally off base. But some other scientists may believe that it got down to as small as 2,000 people wandering the desert for 100,000 years. The human population was as low as 2,000 for a period of 100,000 years.
I like the idea that I think you implied, and correct me if this was not what you were implying, but the idea that maybe that was the period at which we discovered, oh, we can speak. We can communicate better than other ones because we have to solve problems that they're like, oh shit, this is it. It's like Apollo 13. Those people were using all their math knowledge, every part of their brain, to solve the problem of turning that floating, non-functioning coffin into something that could get back into the atmosphere. As a species, who knows how many of the traits that like we now use and take for granted that separate us from other species weren't
like
just discovered then.
Like had to be forced into existence by necessity. Yeah.
Right.
They're and like, by definition, you can never know exactly when or who it was.
Right.
But it's just cool to think about. And like, it just makes you want to see all the post-apocalypse tropes and like, who is the caveman that was warning everyone and they wouldn't listen? Who is the caveman who finally was like, everyone come with me. Yeah. I will lead us and we will live. We must go away from Big Rock to Big Tree for safety.
Right. Well, actually, this is all explained in the new movie, Noah, I think.
Exactly. This whole podcast episode is an ad sale for Noah, right? A big ad buy.
Wait a second. I think I know about a well-known badass by the name of Noah. And then you guys break into song.
I wonder what awesome traits we lost as a species because that guy, just like, maybe he was the one dude in his family who didn't have a tail, and now nobody gets tails.
You mean like divergent traits that were...
Maybe he had male pattern baldness, and that's why it's still around. He was like the one bald guy.
Right, what if there was some weird humanity offshoot of a small tribe of people who were like mildly psychic, but had no legs, so they didn't make it, but we could have been psychic.
And legless.
And legless.
I think my favorite story of military badassness, and it was like more of a small army's doing than one guy, but there's this battle called Alesia. It was Julius Caesar's army against Vercingetorix, which was like the king of all of Europe, basically, of all the tribes that Caesar was trying to conquer. And so Alesia was his home city, and Caesar was laying siege, built a wall around the city and started sieging it, when Vercingetorix attacked him from the outside with his huge army of between like 100,000 and a million people, depending on what sources you listen to. If even it was probably
how poetic they got with it,
yeah. But Caesar had like 8,000 guys, so yeah. Even if it was the low end, he was outnumbered 10-20 to 1. They built a wall around this other city when a huge army attacks them. So what do? They build a wall around themselves, and so they defend against a siege from one side while sieging the city on the other side.
Holy
and they
crap.
Totally won.
Wow.
And that's how Rome won Europe.
That should be like something Jean-Luc Picard did in The Next Generation. That's like such a brilliant... I can't believe books and movies have not stolen that. I can't believe that scene's not a hackneyed scene in movies. That's such a great
it's
maneuver.
It's just too cool, though.
Yeah, it's
like,
so
no,
cool
let's just
to
do.
Do.
Let's build a wall.
Oh, just build another wall. Yeah.
Why well, wouldn't that work?
They have planes. Build a ceiling.
So explain
We're
to
set.
They,
we'll live here now.
He built it around the enemy.
They're attacking a town. You do it.
Yeah, they're attacking a city. So he builds ramparts around the city
so they can't
get
out.
And they can't get out.
Right.
And then he has to build a second set of walls around his interior set of walls to defend his siege from the other siege.
So they've made a moat of themselves.
It's the inception of war fighting. It's
wow.
like a siege inside of another
That's
siege.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. This guy's just, he kind of borders on renegade lunatic.
Is this Sickles?
No, it's
no?
a dude named Richard Demo Dick Marchenko.
Demo Dick.
Demo Dick. Never demo go dick. With the Demo Dick. Always
no.
the real thing.
Well, yeah, wait until they beta tested it.
Yeah. Don't go with the floor model. Be picky with your dick.
So he was a soldier. He's like more recent than any of the guys we're talking about. I think he was a commander of a platoon in Vietnam. He was a number-crunching guy because he was crazy smart, but he really wanted to get into underwater demolition. That's the scariest thing. Like,
yeah.
Nobody wants that. That's where you send, like, the people who you don't mind.
Right.
Yeah. And he, like, was really begging to get on it, and they wouldn't let him, and so he punched a superior in the face, and the punishment for that was being sent to underwater demolition training.
And he knew that ahead of time?
Yeah,
That's great.
So he became one of the most feared people in Vietnam. There was like a huge reward among the North Vietnamese for his head. And his career path basically follows Rambo in that he was this legendary soldier in Vietnam. America would just like drop him and they're like, ah, there's like a lot of fire and bombs over there and we're not really sure what's going on. Just drop him and like his small platoon of crazy badasses in that zone and he would solve the problem or at least do something crazy. And a lot of this stuff is off the record. What we do know is that when peacetime rolled around, they didn't have a lot of stuff to throw him at. And so they created something called Red Cell, where he would basically test the U.S. military security by just doing insane shit that the enemy might try and pull off. So, like, he would break into weapons facilities and kidnap high-ranking personnel and their families and mildly torture them to get nuclear codes. He wound up kidnapping one admiral twice, so the military was like, all right, we get
Stop.
It.
That guy's really yeah. shook up. Please kidnap like, another guy next time.
Yeah.
Not the same guy every time.
He was providing really valuable
right.
intelligence
he's
for
like,
them.
He's America's Pink Panther guy. We're like, okay, wait in my house and just attack me.
Right.
Whenever, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so the side of the military that's like accountable and wants to know where their weaknesses are, we're like, great, let's keep this up. This guy is showing us so much. While the people who like have egos and don't
want
like
our numbers up.
Yeah, don't like to look fucking stupid. We're like, okay, we need to frame him for something. They eventually like got him put in jail for a year after what's reported to be a $60 million investigation to find anything that he had ever done wrong. First, he wrote a memoir that embarrassed everybody and they got really pissed and made him sign a contract that said that he would never write anything on the record. So now he just writes fictional stories of this like quote unquote crazy badass named Richard Darchenko, who like goes around and
demo penis,
right? Yeah, old demo cock Darchenko goes around kidnapping people, and so his autobiography was a number one bestseller, and he is
the person behind the Rogue Warrior series of games. I don't even know.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
like that's based on like his series of
just
novels.
Just like stuff he drunkenly said happened to him.
Right.
Well, they interviewed him. Yeah.
Right.
And they're like, that's a level. Oh my God, that's a level.
Yeah, yeah.
You tortured him for how long? That's a mini game right there.
I just love the idea that he would kidnap their families. There was a part of the military that was like, yeah, go after him. Like, make sure they're not soft.
His final report to the military was, stop paying money for people to attack you. It's really your big hole right there in security.
All right, we're back in studio here, and we had asked some of our writers, Anita Sarwacki, Alex Schmidt, and Adam Todd Brown, to tell us about some of their favorite badasses, and we decided that it would be fun to edit their stories together into one sort of big Frankenstein's monster of badassery.
It's alive! And it's badass!
We're gonna call him Ambrose Bierce because that's one of the guy's names, and it's just the most badass name I've ever heard. And here is the fictional life made up of non-fictional details from the badass life of Ambrose Bierce.
I think my favorite underrated badass is Ambrose Bierce.
The fancy-footed Irish-American dance machine.
He was like a combination Hunter Thompson, Forrest Gump type of character in the 1800s.
He's also an accomplished boxer with a 1975 Golden Gloves championship under his fancy pants belt.
As a writer, he wrote like Satan, better than anyone ever had.
He was a New York State senator, and during that time was going around with one of the most well-known New York City prostitutes and madams of the time. But then
he decided that he was going to go to Mexico and ride with Pancho Villa, who was just constantly fighting people all of the time. Rides into Mexico, reportedly carrying $2,000 in gold on his person, writes a couple letters home from Mexico, and then disappears. There are rumors he was shot by firing squad. There's also a rumor that Villa shot Bierce himself because Bierce was drinking too much of the tequila.
And you don't survive a place like that on dance alone.
When the wife got fed up with that, she took up with her own guy, who happened to be the son of Francis Scott Key, who is the guy who wrote the Star Spangled Banner.
He was just too badass even to die like a normal person. He
was out in D.C. one day and saw Key out on the street and just shot him dead in the street. He went on trial for murder, but was actually the first person to claim temporary insanity, and he actually beat the rap. And so you would think after all of that, he'd maybe lie low. Oh no, he then became a Union general during the Civil War.
Set a world record for tapping his foot 35 times in 1 second.
Had one of his legs blown off, which is probably the only reason he didn't actually end up getting court-martialed. And he used to go visit it every year on the anniversary of the date it was blown off. Still, was that the end of his magical adventures? No, because after that,
he was a commander in the British Army during a war in Kosovo. He was responsible for leading 30,000 troops into the Kosovan capital.
Became the ambassador to Spain and had a torrid one-legged affair with the Queen of Spain.
Released a song in 2005 called "You're Beautiful."
And that's our guy,
Ambrose Bierce.
If he can tap his feet 35 times in 1 second, imagine how many punches he can connect to your face in the same amount of time.
All right, that was the most badass hypothetical life you could possibly lead. Anita was actually talking about Daniel Sickles, the guy who was a New York politician who shot a man in the street, got off for temporary insanity while also inventing that as a defense, got his leg blown off, had an affair with the Queen, like Braveheart. Ambrose Bierce was Alex's guy who, in addition to having that name, was a total badass and died in the best way possible by disappearing into Mexico in just a vapor of manliness. And then Adam's two guys are Michael Flatley, the Lord of the Dance, who also is apparently an amazing boxer, and James Blunt, the guy who sang that You Are Beautiful song, also led a army of like 30,000 people into Kosovo in a war. He was like a huge war hero before he sang that lovely song. All right, back to our conversation with Evans real quick.
Switzerland, and we ran a bit about this in an article a while back, but I just think it's cool because you always think of Switzerland as famously neutral, and if you're American, you think it's because, ha, who cares about Switzerland? But
chocolate or
that's
something?
That's not true. No, it's not because of that. It's because no one wants to fuck with Switzerland. Because they are like Sharon Stone in Quick and the Dead. Or is it Who Sleeps on Dynamite? It's the kid. It's Leo DiCaprio. Anyway, they're like the crazy guy that sleeps on a bomb so that no one can fuck with them in the night. Switzerland has over, how many do we say? Over 3,000 demolition points, meaning places where in their country where they can press a button and the freeway bridge explodes and falls into the river. So that now we're just isolated. So those are the ones that the government will officially list. That's the ones that you can go online and they'll be like, yeah, we have bombs there. Yeah. You know it has to be more than that.
Right.
That can't be the full number.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Just bombs. Sure, yeah, guys. Exactly. Sure, buddy. Whatever you say.
So it's just crazy the amount of dedication. And the Swiss Army actually is a feared force to be reckoned with. The trains, an incredible amount. So it's just Switzerland is very much overlooked. But like one day, we hope, I guess not, God forbid, we'll deploy and just be a crazy fighting force. Like World War III is everyone versus Switzerland. They have hollow mountains full of munitions and equipment that they won't account for. And they had a law every house. Household since 1963 has to have a bomb shelter that can withstand nuclear attack, and it's estimated that right now they could shelter 83% of their population. If they said, hey, nukes are flying, they could just duck underground and then come back, and they'd still have 80% of their people.
They're going to be the 10,000 people who survive us all.
Right? Yeah, that's the new bottleneck right there.
This isn't altogether uncommon, but they have mandatory military service. So basically, they're a country full of dead-eye shots. Everybody has a rifle on them or within
their house.
Oh my God, conspiracy theory. They are prepping for the post-apocalypse. This is so clear. They're the country that invented a tiny knife that is not particularly useful, but would be incredibly useful for small mundane tasks in the post-apocalypse, right? Yeah. Okay, where's the seed vault? Okay, Norway.
I don't trust that whole region.
I'm very suspicious now. Of this region.
I didn't know the thing about that they like have the bomb the bridges out in case people invade. So they're like, oh, you're not getting out now. Like, I like that idea that they're like, they blow the bridges up once you cross the thing.
Oh, big mistake.
You're
not
oh, you're fucked now,
you're
man.
You're in my house now, son.
But they're right between, what is that, Italy, Germany, and France?
Yeah. Not a great place to be.
Yeah, so they're like in a really rough location, and they've just never been fucked with.
Right.
It's like not shocking that there's something.
They're like the innocent man thrown into prison for murder who just knows on the first day to be like, make a shiv
just
and give everyone crazy eye. Just always be doing crazy eye, and no one will ever fuck with you. All they got to do is hop over to Norway, raid the seed vault, and they're like ruling the post-apocalyptic landscape. This is my prediction.
They're probably like rookie move Norway telling people about your seed vault.
Yeah, we've had a seed vault here.
You fucking kidding me, man? <They're> like, we fucking hollowed out our mountains, man. Yeah.
Like nothing but seeds in those motherfuckers.
Hollowed out mountains is such a crazy move. Right? Yeah. The Alps are just like filled with post-apocalyptic Swiss cities.
And the world's finest chocolate.
Yeah, exactly. It's like officially they're in a really good place if things go to hell because like all the gold's stored there. And then like sort of in a really gritty street fight way, they're like in the best position. That's like really unnerving
it might
to
be
know
like
that
a
they're
like long-term heist that they're pulling on the whole world economy.
Yeah.
That would be really crazy.
Okay, this
come
is
get it.
See, this is a $200 million like Roland Emmerich movie that we're pitching where and
the
you
Swiss
never
deception.
The one you never suspected. 2018, Switzerland takes
the
over.
The president wakes up, sir, all of the money's gone. All
right.
of it.
It's like Canadian bacon, but seriously.
See, the problem is you know the Swiss prime minister or whatever the fuck they have is listening to the Cracked podcast right now going, mobilize, they know.
Blow the bridges.
Yeah.
Time has come.
Even if you conquer them, they can turn around and go, yes, some of the Alps are filled with gold. Some of the Alps are filled with bombs. Mine away.
All right, that was our episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I do want to say really quickly, so this episode, randomly, we recorded that conversation before the person who I knew who was sort of the closest to the sort of epic badassness
that we were talking about in this episode passed away, actually, this past weekend. My grandfather, Jack Ramsey. Michael, sorry to suddenly get sentimental on you here.
You mean just flatten me with 10 metric tons of badass?
Yeah.
That's what you've done, sir.
Yeah, he was a total badass. He was a frogman in World War II. They invented what it was to be a Navy SEAL before they had all the fancy equipment. He was the captain of a naval ship by age 21. My favorite anecdote is when he was a grandfather, he once flipped his car while he was on the way to the airport, crawled out, called a cab, and caught his flight. He was just tough to slow down. He was a force of nature. He's doesn't really qualify as unknown. He's pretty well known in basketball circles. He's one of the most successful basketball coaches in NBA history and college. He was a good college coach. And a lot of these people who we mentioned are people that we've covered on Cracked on the site that I've been running since 2006, I think. And I think we cover these sorts of amazing, hopeful, uncynical stories about real amazing people doing epic, badass things as well and as much as anyone. And I think at least part of the reason for that is because I got to witness one of them, one of these sort of epic, larger than life people in person. So, you know, I have some fairly cynical views, but I've never been cynical about the possibility that people like that exist. All right, on to footnotes. Tried to pick songs by people who also led interesting, huge, giant, epic lives. We heard Viva Nigeria by Fela Kuti, the inventor of the musical genre called Afrobeat, sort of a jazz, hip-hop, two-saxophone-y thing that still sounds new today. He recorded this particular song in 1969 in L.A. in a studio session. He had to rush because he'd been hanging out with Black Panthers in America, and the government paid attention to that sort of thing and was going to run him out of the country because he didn't have a visa. So he just laid down that track real quick and then fled the country and went on to be an awesome revolutionary. Next, we heard Bird's Lament by Moondog, a blind guy who you could find performing on the streets of New York in the 1940s. If you're super old, he wore homemade leather pants, a horned helmet, and a cape, and was, by all appearances, just a crazy street performer type guy, and actually ended up being one of the most influential musicians in New York at the time. And we're gonna ride out on Biggie Smalls' verse from Victory, which is one of my favorite of his verses, and it was released after he was shot to death in LA. His funeral procession basically shut down Brooklyn with fans and famous rappers, and it's sort of legendary. They just released his coroner's report, and the things he had on him when he died listed in the coroner's report included bag of pot, an asthma inhaler, and three extra super large magnum sized condoms. And we're gonna ride out on that. Thanks for listening. Back next week with more podcast. You just mad cause I tell her how it is and you tell her how it might be. We got this shit mapped tight, brass knuckles and flashlights, the heaters and the two seaters with two meters, senoritas, kiss rings when you meet us. B Diddy run the city, show no pity. I'm the witty one, Frank the crook from the brook. Maddie broke the neck off your coat connect. No respect, squeeze off to all y'all diminish. Shootouts for 20 minutes until we finish. Then it's to the loot, escape in the coupe, break bread with the kiss. Panero, chic loots, Black Rob join the mob. It ain't no replacing him, niggas step up. We just macing them, placing them in funerals. Criminals turn the vows to Brick City. Nobody come off like P. Diddy. Business wise, I play men. Hide money on the island, Cayman. Y'all just betray men, you spray men. Opposition, competition of the day in the life of the commission. Commission. We got the real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world, where the fuck you at? Where my niggas is at? Where my niggas is at? Where the fuck my bitches at? Where my bitches is at? We got the real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world, where the fuck you at? Where my niggas is at? Where my niggas is at? Where the fuck my bitches at? Where my bitches is at? We got the real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world, where the fuck you at? Where my niggas is at? Where my bitches is at? We got the real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world, where the fuck you at? Where my niggas is at? Where my niggas is at? Where the fuck my bitches at? Where my bitches is at? We got the real live shit.
Now that the show's over, rats, make sure to head on over to squarespace.com to keep the party going and start your free trial with no credit card required. When you inevitably decide to sign up for Squarespace, do make sure to use the offer code CRACKED to get 10% off and to let them know we sent you.